Dr. Mukil, this is Ambreen, and welcome to my podcast. Thank you so much for joining. I know you're very busy, and because you're an ER physician, but I really appreciate that you took time out. And we would start with introductions. You were trained at the University of Michigan for medical school, and after that, in your previous career, you worked in Silicon Valley. Now, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I would like to know more about what kind of a startup did you work on?
Okay. So yeah, I actually left, I was pre-med in undergrad, and I thought I was going to be a doctor when I was in college, and I decided not to. It was a whole philosophical debate about how I wanted to live my life, and I didn't like being around pre-meds when I was in undergrad. They were way too type A and to wound up for me. So I ended up going into software in Silicon Valley. This is during the dot-com boom in the late 90s. And I thought I would make a lot of money and buy an island and, you know, fund a university or something like that. Okay. And I actually ended up working for a couple of different ones. It's very technical, but they were in kind of similar to AI and search and understanding natural language. And we had some pretty cool startups, and I did some pretty cool things with them. But, you know, like a lot of startups at that time, the main one I was working on failed overnight. And I was left at 30 years old with two kids and no money, and living in San Francisco, California, or the Bay Area, which is one of the most expensive places. So I decided to go to medical school because of that experience, essentially.
That is a wonderful story. Tell us more. Like, that's so like some of the trajectories, you know, some of the career paths of other physicians, and it's so interesting. I think that is why it makes you very compassionate person, because from what I know briefly about you, I don't know a lot, but from what it seems, I think that is the factor that I think brought compassion into your work.
One of the things I noticed with some of my classmates in med school was I remember having a classmate in her fourth year of med school, and she dropped out. She's just like, no, this isn't for me. I don't want to do it. And I've had a couple of residency people that I knew kind of dropped out once they kind of experienced the reality of medicine. And I think one of the things that having a previous career did for me was give me the perspective that there are bad jobs out there, and there are really hard jobs out there, and medicine has its problems, you know, for sure. And, you know, it's a job like any other, and you've got terrible bosses, and, you know, your pay is negotiable, and you can get fired, and all the kind of things that go along with a job, but it's a pretty good job, you know, comparatively speaking. And I think that was the main takeaway that I have from my previous career, is like, yeah, medicine's pretty good. despite everything,
I can do this.
Yeah, I can do this. Medicine's pretty good.
Right. And again, you know, I just printed out one of the, you know, tweets that you tweeted, and it said that you worked in a lot of different, like you work in like almost like 15 different sort of professions. Like you worked as a product manager, as a knowledge engineer, as a hotel event staff, as a bookstore worker, as an English tutor, as a chemistry tutor, as a dishwasher, as a cafeteria. That's a long list.
That's due to my parents, who, rightly or wrongly, I can argue with them or not, but they insisted that that independence was a core value they wanted to instill in their children.
Right.
And so I've been working since I was 14, and including during all throughout my education, all throughout high school and undergrad. And I even had a job during med school, and it's you know, I paid for my undergrad. So basically, as soon as I turned 18, I was cut off from my parents' financial braces. So it was by necessity.
Right. I think that's amazing. That's awesome. So how did that influence some of the choices in your life? Like, do you feel?
Well, honestly, I think it gave me a lot of work ethic, which is good. But I also think it has a little bit colored me and my decision making to be very worried and kind of focus on money, which, you know, I it would have been nice to have the luxury to kind of pursue, you know, things independent of the financial aspect of that. And even today, you know, when I'm in a very good financial place, I still kind of, you know, worry about what the next step is and worry about, you know, what the, you know, my future holds. And it kind of instills a little bit of anxiety, you know, baseline financial anxiety in there, even when I don't need to have it. And I think I raised my kids a little bit that way, and I wish I hadn't. You know, I wish I'd been a little bit more open and loving with them, and rather than harsh, and you have to be this way, and you have to have this ambition, and you have to achieve this, and you know, you have to get to this next stage. So it's a mixed bag. You know, I definitely have a good work ethic, you know, from it, and I definitely, you know, am able to accomplish things because of the amount of effort I put into it, but it's a mixed bag.
Right. So I know you're really busy as an ER physician. So what is your biggest challenge as like a leadership challenge?
In terms of, well, that's a broad question. There's, you know, so
keep it broad and then you can narrow it down.
So I mean, you know, there's challenges as a physician, obviously, and you have leadership challenges there. I think one of the bigger leadership challenges as a practicing physician is honestly being a role model to those around you. You know, I'll go into shifts sometimes not in a good mood, you know, not wanting to be positive, or not wanting to, you know, I'm tired or you know, whatever. And, you know, I might be a little snappy with a nurse or with a tech or with a medical student, and they notice, and you know, that comes back, and you get a reputation from it. And so I think as a clinician being in a leadership position, eyes are always on you. And every decision you make medically, every, you know, time you snap at somebody, every time you don't respond in a, you know, completely cordial way, I think you get judged. And I think that that's difficult because, you know, we're all human and we're all tired and we're all, you know, under pressure while we're working on the job. You know, I think that's a big part of it. From a kind of administrative standpoint, most of my background is in academics, so in administration of residency programs and in academics. And I think some of the bigger challenges in the academic realm as a leader is really trying to figure out what is important to instill in residents and in education, and what is kind of stuff that you have to do but you don't really think is important. So there's a lot of fluff in academics. There's a lot of kind of requirements that, you know, academics is big and institutional and corporate. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we have to do in academics that I don't think are necessary, but it's part of being, you know, an academician, you know, whether it's publication or whether it's, you know, doing all these requirements or anything like that. And so I think the challenge for me is trying to maintain that core of mission-driven education and mission-driven administration, and saying, this is what I want to teach residents. This is what I want to instill in them. Yeah, we have to do all this extra stuff, but that's not the core of why we're doing it. And that, to me, I think you can get bogged down in the details and lose sight of the big picture sometimes. And I think that that's a challenge. That's an ongoing daily challenge.
Right. And okay. So you have started, like you mentioned, the mission-driven education is your passion, and you've started this, you know, designing this emergency medicine residency, right? So do you think there's a specific criteria for people who are applying? And what do you think about ageism? Do you think like people at a certain age are not supposed to apply for ER residencies?
Well, no, because the second question first. I was 32 when I started medical school, which meant I was 36 when I started my emergency medicine residency. And I had an older classmate in residency with me. He had been a soldier, and then he'd been a nurse, and then, you know, he went to residency late in life. So for emergency medicine specifically, I think I think it's a great specialty for people who are non-traditional, mostly because it's kind of shift work. You can kind of work as much or as little as you want once you're in your career. I feel like the people in emergency medicine tend to be a little bit more accepting and laid back than a lot of other specialties. And so people with
I thought it was the other way around.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think while you're at work, you know, it's an intense, hardcore environment, but we like to have fun. We like to have fun. We like to, you know, cut loose. And I think we are very open and accepting of anybody who comes on there.
Okay.
Well, I'm not going to badmouth other specialties. So, so, but no, I think it's a great specialty
That's definitely
non-traditional resident. Okay. I forgot what the first part of your question was.
I think it slipped my mind as well. Yes, okay. I was talking about like the mission-driven aspect of it, like how do you feel about designing that kind of like environment, and how is it different from, let's say, any other year?
Yeah. Well, I think this was one of the frustrations of my previous role before I came here. So before I came to my current job, where I was hired specifically to start a new residency and design it, and to kind of build it from the ground up, I had been working as an assistant residency director at a very large and old and well-established program. And I loved it. I loved my job. But I think at some point it's kind of on autopilot. And a lot of education can be that way. You know, you have requirements that need to be checked. You have a certain number of rotations you have to do. You have to see X number of patients, you know, whatever. And so I think it's very easy to recruit a strong student, kind of plug them into the system, you know, have them meet all their requirements. They get their education. They come out a great doctor, which is fine. But there is not a lot of room for innovation. And there's not a lot of room, I think, to really put your own stamp on things, whether as a residency director or as a resident coming into a system like that.
Right.
And, you know, if you have a specific vision that you want to implement, you know, you're in this behemoth, this well-established machine, and it's hard to kind of implement that. So I think one of the things that really, really excited me about starting my own program was, you know, I have a passion for healthcare advocacy for the community and making sure that, you know, clinical education is the bedrock for all other parts of training, whether it's research or leadership or anything like that. And, you know, I really, really strongly believe that the way a resident is going to get the most out of their own education is to be able to have ownership of their own educational experience. And so if I can design a program that gives the resident maximal autonomy, and, you know, teaches them all the medicine they need to learn and gives them exposure to all the sick patients they need to see, but at the same time lets them have input onto their educational environment, gives them support to start research projects or support to start, you know, advocacy projects, or, right, you know, gives them space to explore their career in a way that I might not have thought of, you know, or I might not particularly have a passion for. Right. But if I can give residents.
What do residents are usually?
I think it's hard to judge that from an application. You know, so I don't know, honestly, you know, what part of the application I can look at that say, oh, that person looks innovative, or, you know, in the interview. I mean, I'm sure we can try to suss that out a little bit. But I don't know. You know, I think it's going to be an experiment for me, and I'm going to kind of, you know, pick some people and kind of see if that works. And, you know, if it doesn't, you know, kind of go from there. But I've worked with some very innovative people. You know, I had a resident a few years ago who was very passionate about women's health from the emergency department. And she lobbied the state legislature to kind of change some of the state laws about you know, about women's health. And she lobbied the School of Medicine to change the work hours for pregnant residents. And, you know, she got some very innovative changes in there. I've worked with residents who, you know, were passionate about global health, and they, you know, established a relationship with a hospital in Nepal, and were able to, you know, get ongoing research projects with them. And, you know, so it's kind of, I can't predict, you know, what people are going to do. It's all over the spectrum. And that's kind of the fun part about emergency medicine, is we're a little bit of plug and play doctors. You know, we can go anywhere, we can do anything. We can do aerospace medicine, we can do advocacy, we can do, you know, wilderness medicine. And so, you know, I think finding people who have that creativity and who have that desire to
experiment,
just make something up and experiment. I did that when I was a resident. I was told that I had to, if I wanted to get a job at the university I was working at, I had to be fellowship trained. I didn't want to leave the city, so, and none of the fellowships that they had offered were appealing to me. So I designed my own fellowship. And I, you know, during residency, I created, a curriculum. I talked to faculty. I looked at different organizations. I compared the curriculum to other existing curricula, in the parts of the country. I got it approved by the GME committee. And so I created a fellowship that I ended up doing, and, it was a lot of fun. And it was, you know, that gave me so much more, personal satisfaction than, you know, doing a pre-established fellowship that I would have, you know, applied for and gotten into and completed and earned a degree in, and, you know, kind of got in practice. So it gave me a lot more experience and a lot more
excitement. That's so exciting. At the same time, I think you've been doing it for a period of time. That's why you're so good at it, that, you know, you've been able to design your own.
Part of it is practice. Part of it's, you know, kind of getting that experience of, you know, I can kind of do this. But part of it is a mindset. You know, part of it is just, you have to realize that if you don't fit into the path that's laid out in front of you, you don't have to keep marching down that path. You can jump off, you know, you can try something brand new. And so I think that's just a mindset. And people just have to kind of know that sometimes, if you're laid out a set of options, some of those options are not any of these options, you know, to go off and do something completely different. And I think, if we can encourage our learners to just have the space to have that mindset, and, you know, to provide them with examples around them of people who are doing, you know, things that, you know, hadn't previously been done before, then I think it, you know, it's beneficial to them. And I think
interesting, but I feel like a lot of people don't even know they have options. They feel they have to, you know, they don't even think that way. Or just like, they drop out and they just leave because they feel that, you know, they won't be able to like negotiate or find a path. So they just feel, they don't even know that there are options that exist.
I agree. It's very sad because, you know, I think what we were talking about before about having a previous career, and people who go straight through, you know, from high school or college to med school, to residency, to, you know, the academic job. And, you know, they kind of feel like there's this certain path that's laid out from them. And I think it's very mind numbing sometimes. And also, I think it's hard if you fail or stumble at any one of those levels of the path, then you kind of feel like your life is over. You know, you feel like there's nothing else laid out there for you. And so I think if you have a background where you don't come from this traditional path, or if you have this realization that, you know, not everything is laid out in this path and there are options outside of that path, then I think it's easier to handle failure and it's easier to innovate too. You know, if you come up with some idea of how to do it.
Absolutely. So what is this one procedure that you absolutely hate or has been the most challenging for you? Absolutely hate. You don't want to do it. You want to delegate it. Sure.
All procedures are kind of fun, honestly. I mean, you know,
if you were to pick one which you like, don't like at all.
So lumbar punctures in large awake people. Lumbar punctures are fairly straightforward. Yeah, but they're not fun, and or positioning them. Intubating babies is always scary, you know, because the risk is so high. It's not particularly difficult, but it's not fun. It's terrifying, you know, I think to have to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, LPs and large people, it's a challenge.
Do you have any story to go with that? Why do you have that?
No, you have somebody who's obese and they're altered and they're febrile and you know that, you know, you've got to kind of figure this thing out. And, you know, they're, you know, especially altered people, they can't cooperate with you very well. And so if they're sitting there and you're trying to do this and you get the longest needle you can and you're, you know, trying to do your thing, it's just, they're uncomfortable, you're uncomfortable, you know your chance of success, you're sweating, you know, kind of thing. you're kind of sterile, so you're trying to, you know, mop up the sweat as best you can. Your glasses are fogging up and
oh no. And he can tell like your doc is not in a good shape.
Yeah, right. You're like, oh,
so you have to put up that face also.
I do that. Actually, art lines are kind of, I don't super enjoy art lines either.
Why is that?
They're not something I do as frequently as some of my other procedures. So I'm not super comfortable with as comfortable with them as some of my other procedures. They're painful, you know, in an awake patient, you know, more so than, you know, some of the other things we do. And it's just, you know, sometimes if you've got a hypotensive patient, which is the patient you want to put an art line in, then finding that little artery is, you know, sometimes difficult. So it's, I remember, in residency, I was on an ICU rotation and I probably tried for an hour to get an art line on a patient, and I couldn't. I was so frustrated and I was getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And my attending came in and all he did differently was he sat down on a stool and he positioned the patient differently and he made himself comfortable. He was just like, you know, kind of got into this Zen thing and he just took it slow. He did this very nice, you know, smooth approach. He was sitting, he was comfortable. Mm-hmm. And he got it.
So
I think what that
how
taught
does
me
that
was,
make you feel?
Well, yeah, I think what that taught me was, you know, I kind of had to analyze my own failure and my thought process during that. And I think what that taught me was my own frustration and discomfort, you know, made me fail. And so I've since then always tried to approach procedures of, you know, maximizing my comfort in that situation, whether it's, you know, sitting down, whether it's, absolutely, you know, cooling off, or whether it's having everything, you know. So I think the more calm I can be and the more methodical in my approach and the more comfortable I am in those procedures, that the better success I tend to have in those.
And that's my next question. How do you stay calm? Like, what do you do to relax, unwind? And let's say
during a shift or during after shifts? Those are two different things.
Both. Like, let's say you have, you know, you also do a lot of crisis management. You do a lot of, like, you know, there are all sorts of things that happen in the emergency room. So how do you go into that Zen moment? Like, what triggers you and then what brings back? And how do other people, like, how can other people learn?
So part of it is truly, truly, truly just experience. You know, the more crises you face, the more you just get used to it, and it's part of the job, and you have to, you know, just do your job despite the chaos going around you. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest learning moments for me during residency, when I would start running a code, or when I would watch attendings run codes and, you know, see examples of how different people do it, is that the more frustrated and loud and out of control the doctor appears, mm-hmm, then the rest of the room will respond the same way. And the more calm a doctor appears, and, you know, we're the leaders in that room. And so I think just witnessing that from a resident and a learner perspective and seeing how different attendings handle things, mm-hmm. you know, I had to make this conscious choice that no matter how nervous I was or how, you know, panicked I was about a certain situation, I had to be outwardly calm. And that meant modulating my voice, you know, meant never raising my voice. It meant standing still, you know, in the room. You know, I would stand, you know, with my arms crossed. Mm-hmm. I would speak in a very direct but flat, you know, tone of voice. And I, you know, would just, you know, kind of control the room that way. And even, and I think early on, it was maybe a bit of a facade. You know, I acted that way because that's how I, that was more effective in running these crisis situations. But after a while, your behavior, you know, influences your attitude. And so the more you behave that way, the more you become that way. And so, you know, anytime a code is called or anytime a code was called, then I would walk briskly, but I wouldn't run. You know, I'd walk briskly to the room. I would take a deep breath and pause and walk in the room, and I wouldn't say anything for about 5 seconds. And I would just watch the room, see what was going on. Then I would start getting my bearings, and then I would speak. And, you know, and I think that kind of slow and deliberate and thoughtful approach, you know, it lets you kind of absorb things. It slows your own mind down, but it also slows the room down a little bit in a way that's pretty effective. But, you know, and I've seen the opposite. I've seen people, oh my God, you know, who's got the airway? Who's got the, you know, and start yelling and it becomes chaotic, you know, everybody yells back, you know, and when the doctor's yelling at nurses, the nurses yell back and the respiratory therapist and everybody yells and the room just becomes loud and unmanageable and it's bad for patient care.
Yeah, absolutely. The energy just changes as soon as one person starts yelling. Yeah, that is so true. Thank you so much. I think we're towards the end of our podcast. We just have like a few minutes left. I really appreciate that you took time out. I know you're super busy. And it's early morning, but not early, but like...
I know. I didn't realize it's probably late for you, but I appreciate you accommodating my time.
Yes. And